In this Edgar podcast, we had the pleasure of speaking with Irish golfer Paul O'Rahilly. His story is fascinating as it shows how positive experiences in golf can change your perceptions of everything. Let's hear about a champion, her caddy, and his epiphanies on life and golf. Apart from the carrying of the bag and all the measuring and technical analysis needed, the caddy does so much more. They are a mine of information, the voice of reason, often taken for granted, walking alongside the player. They are a witness in time, listening, empathising, learning. With the right inspiration, a caddy can change the golf world around them in an instant. Here's the story of one caddy, or rather two, both humble bag carriers who have made a significant mark on the game in their own way. A tall man walks to the first tee with his caddy. There is the dampness still in the air after the rain, a breeze enough to flap at collars and cuffs. The ground of the teeing area is firm. Crows in the tall trees become quieter as the group of spectators have arrived to watch this match. He is waiting to play. Paul meets the official starter, who is particularly clear in his instructions. Paul then swaps his card with his fellow competitor. All the time he is absorbing the facts as he feels them, hears them, while steadying his nerves to hopefully hit a good opening shot. The official starter calls out, "On the tee, Paul O'Rahilly, Ireland," to a smatter of applause. The starter doesn't add more, but also on the tee is John. John is Paul's guide and caddy of 25 years, for O'Rahilly is blind. So John will guide Paul around the course on every shot, will assist his stride on this at times hilly course. His role is crucial, and John is the right person for the job. A unique character and a courageous one, travelling to the event despite having coped with a recent severe illness. But there was no way John was going to miss the biggest G4D, Golf of the Disabled event, Paul has ever qualified for. The first tee at the Duchess course, Woburn, is one of the most challenging starts in all of golf. This is the G4D Open, run by the RNA in partnership with the DP World Tour. 9 sport classes covering all disabilities. Paul is one of 80 players from 19 countries taking part. There are a few visually impaired players in the field, but Paul happens to be the only V1 golfer present, meaning a player who is towards 100% blind. To the relief of both men, Paul gets his drive away okay on the first. His tournament has started well. Their tournament has started well. Paul remembers being a very good player, who could see well in his late teens. There is muscle memory and experience there, but the game is incredibly difficult for a V1 player. Paul is unfazed, though, and tells us, "I shouldn't be able to play golf at all, being blind, but in those rare moments when I make a good strike, execute a birdie or sign for a winning score, I feel like the deaf Beethoven conducting a great symphony, or the mobility impaired physicist Stephen Hawking on writing about the history of time. It's moments like these that inspire me to get up in the morning." With his friend John on the bag, this takes Paul back to his own days as a caddy when he could see everything around him just as well as anyone. Back then, the eagle-eyed teenager was guiding players around some beautiful courses in the southeast of Ireland in the late 1970s. But as well as sharp eyes, it was also about the ability to listen, to empathise with the player you are working for. Now 61 years old, Paul says he still has the mind of a caddy and now perhaps plays with the combined heart and soul of two people. Paul and John are a team, shot for shot, step for step. Paul also has a vivid memory as a boy caddying for a genuine champion of the game, a golfer who would have a genuine impact on his life, empowering his thinking about right and wrong in life and helping him create a stoic philosophy that he would need to draw on later. During the Troubles in Northern Ireland in the early 1970s, Wexford was a peaceful town in the south of Ireland, but the divide between Catholics and Protestants was ever present. Different churches, schools, friendships and relationships, and even sports. As a Catholic, Paul would play hurling, but not rugby or cricket. It was just the way it was.
I recall going to school and listening to the stories of the troubles on the radio, the troubles in the north of Ireland, and troubles in Vietnam and places like this. Was in the early 70s. And you know, my recollection of the world at that stage was a very violent place, but I was very lucky to live in this quiet little corner. But sports was split along religious lines. It was split also along gender lines. And throughout the 70s, I was kind of fortunate to experience how our society changed, became more of a pluralist society. And sport changed with that.
In the sport of golf, while girls and women might be playing at the local pitch and putt course, which was very popular in Wexford, at the local golf club, social status held sway. Businessmen, doctors and lawyers, nearly all male, were teeing it up. But Wexford was a quiet, dreamlike place, and it's no fluke that two of the world's great writers, John Banville and Colm Tóibín, originated from the area. In the latter's case, Tóibín was brought up only a few miles away from Paul's house. There's little doubt they would have passed by each other as youngsters in the coastal village of Blackwater, as they were both often there. And there is every chance the poet and writer, when perhaps cycling along, may have spied a young lad in his own dream throwing a ball against the bricks of the family home, emulating the sport on television or radio that day.
Tennis and whatever was on the television, cricket. I was out at the Gable End living like every child does, you know, the FA Cup final or Wimbledon or whatever. You know, that's really where I kind of honed my, for what they're worth, ball coordination skills. Absolutely did that. So, you know, when it came time to play football, I got on the team, and when it came time to play golf, I got on the team, and you know, I progressed. But a lot of it, I think, comes down to that, is having that Gable End. That's the best thing I think you can give a child.
Paul was introduced to the game by his dad, Jerry, and spent 7 years watching, 7 years learning, and seven competing, he says. The family would move to Dublin when Paul was 10, and a little later, father and son started playing together at the famed course, the Hermitage, near Dublin. The Irish PGA Championship was staged there in 1978, and young Paul volunteered as a runner, tearing back and forth with two copies of the scorecards, running one up to the press room and the other to those operating the large scoreboards. He would meet Irish golfing greats, Eamon Darcy, Christy O'Connor Sr., Des Smith and others. But his favourite memory comes from the following year when the European Ladies Team Championship was staged. Then he caddied for Catherine Lacoste, the 1967 US Women's Open champion, the only amateur to lift the trophy. Paul says Catherine Lacoste left a lasting legacy and influence on many at the Hermitage in her week in Dublin.
And I got to caddy for her, and it was the most wonderful experience, and it completely changed my perspective on the game, because I was playing it with this lady, and she was just able to do anything with the golf ball. They were playing off the metal tees. She was driving the ball as far as any man in our club, hitting it a lot more accurately, and she was just an astonishing sportswoman. And it completely changed my perspective on the game and who the game was for. Very relaxed, whatever company she was in, whether it was, you know, I felt very comfortable with her. I was just a teenage boy at the time. I didn't feel in any way intimidated. And, you know, she was able to get on with with everybody who was there, the other golfers, the dignitaries that were visiting. Obviously, there were kind of fans following her around as well. She was very relaxed with those people. An extraordinary person. And I've followed her career since, of course. And she's an inspiration in ladies golf in France, where she lives.
Young boys can get absorbed in a task or mindset, and it can take a flash of lightning to make them think for themselves independently. Paul will tell you this pairing of caddy and player, Catherine Lacoste and himself, had a huge impact. Today, Paul is a great supporter of inclusion in sport and wider life. Perhaps also his open-mindedness, the ability to listen and imagine, all reached new heights because of what started to happen next for him. For only a year after caddying for Catherine, that opportunity we all take for granted to watch, to see the world unfold in front of you at a wonderful time in life, started to ebb away. Paul tells us in an email, I was age 16. I was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, RP, by my local optometrist during a routine sight check. He fixed my astigmatism but couldn't do a damn thing about the advancing black splodges spreading across my retina. Soon after this, at the age of 21, he had become a single-figure golf handicap. At first, Paul found that his dad and friends were needed to spot where his long drives were finishing. Then, one by one, the challenges came to Paul. There were plateaus. Just as the local literary hero Colm Tóibín went to study at the University College Dublin, Paul also went soon after to study a degree in engineering. 7 years after graduation, he began to experience difficulties at work, but continued to work as a design engineer and project manager until his sight failed him, aged 44, in 2008. A career he loved came to an end.
I suppose losing your sight is a bit like, it's like a death, and you do go through stages of grief. A friend of mine, Michael Griffith, wrote a very good book on this. And he talks about the different stages of grief and how you experience a parallel to that as you are losing your sight, because you lose so much from your life, and it's very gradual. And you think, oh God, you know, a couple of years ago I could read a book, a few years before that I could drive. That's all gone out of my life. But I don't think you can dwell on that. You know, you have to keep looking forward. One of the best bits of advice I got from an ophthalmologist, a guy called Dr. Catford, he said, look, Paul, there's nothing I can do for you. Science just hasn't moved on. But he said to me, you look like the type of guy who'd be able to accept the challenge of sight very well. Just see it as a challenge. And even though he wasn't able to, it's the problem. He just put a thought in my head that stayed with me. So I thought, oh, okay, I can't navigate walking as well as I used to, but you know, let's try and find a new way of doing that. I can't navigate my studies as quickly as I used to, but I'll find a way of getting around that. And you begin to find a new way of doing things. And I discovered very early that sharing what I could see and what I couldn't see with other people actually caused them to help me. That people wants to help me, like at work, socially. And that was like, oh, okay, I didn't think people would do that. I thought people were actually quite selfish, but they're not.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was, so you learn these things as you go along. Well, it's like everything in life. You just do it the wrong way first and learn. Actually figure out the right way of doing things. So look at, I've, you know, you do a lot of silly things when you can't see. You're talking to somebody and they walk away and you don't know they've walked. But you end up standing there looking like a fool and talking to yourself and this and that. But you gotta kind of get over that. Just have a laugh about it. You learn to do that. I think there's a lot of space left in your brain to use that you were using to process visual imagery. And I think I use that part to imagine the world. That's around me. So I'm constantly looking for clues, whether they're audio clues or whether it's someone with them and asking them what's there, what's in front of me. And I will try and build up a picture of what's there around it. You know, the other aspect of continuing with sport and continuing with studying, continuing with work, you know, while you're living with a disabling condition is that you learn other skills. You learn how to socialize. You learn how to get on with people. That's so important. It's so important as you progress in life as well.
Paul writes to us, I brought up my earlier cadding now for a reason, because I never thought in 1979 that this experience is something I would impart to people caddying and guiding for me when I lost my sight. So I know exactly what John is going through when he helps me. One day we are talking via Zoom and we are waiting for John to come to Paul's house so he can discuss how the pair got on at Woburn. John, age 60, has worked on his family farm since he was 15 and he still works the farm today. His eventual arrival is somewhat noisy and disruptive as he proceeds to hunt through Paul's fridge to find a generous snack after coming straight from the field. Paul just chuckles away and returns to the psychological battle he wanted to talk about the game for the player and the guide.
I always appreciate a well-designed golf hole as well. So I'm always very keen, you know, before I go and play a course, I'll find out which are the feature holes and what is it about the hole? So I try and get a good picture in my head of those. Like the 17th in Woburn is an extraordinary golf hole. It's very undulating and it's got that dip in front of the green and the big bunker on the left. And I wanted to know all the information about that hole. And I didn't take a buggy because I wanted to feel the course under my feet and just feel the clever way in which the hole had been designed and to appreciate that. And that's something I appreciate as well. I even put the ball in the bunker and got out in one shot.
We now move on to how Paul takes a shot, and Paul and John describe this process as something of a mantra, which goes around lie, length and line. So what's this about, I ask?
The mantra that John and I go by is lie, length and line. So we come up to a ball, the first thing that John gives me is the lie of the ball. So we'll say, it's a pitch shot. I'm near the green. He's got the ball sitting down a bit. It's your right foot's above your left foot. And immediately I'm thinking, you know, what sort of shot it is I have to play. And then the next thing is length. So the three has lie length. You say you're about 40 yards out and it's 30 yards to the green and you got to stop it pretty quickly. And you got to land it on the green because it's very rough. You know, he gave me all this information pertaining to length. So the shot is forming in my head that I need to play. This is all part of the pre-shot. And then ready to hit the ball, I choose a club. He puts it down behind the ball, sets the face, says, you're good to go. I get into my stance, just go and hit the ball. It's very important when you're playing line golf that the guy tells you where the ball has gone.
Exactly.
There's nothing worse, you know, to hit the ball, think if you had a good shot and you get silence, you know, crickets. You have to would someone tell me where the ball's gone, please? So it's really important, to, you know, and to get a description of how the ball flew. Did it go high as intended? Did it come out low? Did it check when it hit the green? All of that information, as much information as you can give me. And that, I can connect that back then to how I executed the shot. And if there's something in the outcome that I hadn't intended, then I'll try and fix that the next time. So getting a quick post-shot analysis. But the post-shot needs to be descriptive and not judgmental. And this is where sometimes, you know, I'll hit a rubbish shot, you know, and maybe once a hole, I'm afraid, Ben, I'll hit an absolute rubbish shot, like out of the toe or top it, and it does happen. Hard to believe, but it does happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, John's inclination is to say, it was a rubbish shot. And say, well, look, that doesn't help. What you just said doesn't help. Did you know, just describe what happened, because that's what helps. That's what will help me fix the swing. And it also keeps you then in a more positive frame of mind as well. So getting a good description.
Like any partnership after 25 years, familiarity can come into play. And Paul accuses John of losing interest when he is playing badly, which gets a laugh from John. Occasional swearing matches do occur between the two friends. But Paul wouldn't change it for the world. John was a strong sportsman in his younger days, representing local teams at hurling and soccer, and when Paul still had his sight, he took John to the range to help him improve his golf. Paul says, "We played some golf together. At the time, I could see the ball on the fairway, but needed him to watch the ball for me once it was struck. However, as my sight deteriorated, John played less and caddied more. He got hooked on caddying for me, particularly when we got into the position to compete for and win tournaments. Without John's friendship and support on and off the course, I simply couldn't play the game." John himself is all too modest about his skill as a guide and his total support of his friend, other than to say how much he enjoys the role. But Paul is in no doubt about John's skills, however.
He doesn't think he's very good, but I know he's very good. Let me see, what's the best way of putting it? When I'm playing badly, it's a challenge, you know, to try and get him to stay focused. But when I'm playing well, he really gets behind me. And his enthusiasm to get me to play, keep me playing well, helps me play even better. Where John is really good, or where we're really good as a partnership is within, you know, from 10 feet in. His, you know, the level of attention he gives the short putts is 110%. And that, you know, when you're sinking every four footer on the golf course and making a lot of six and 10 footers as well, you relax from tee to green, because you know that you're not going to mess things up near the hole. You have that confidence. And that's where John is really, really good. And that comes from just playing together so much. He's been caddying for me for nearly 25 years now. So he knows what sort of a putter I am. He's confident that I'm going to hit it where he aims it. And he gets a buzz out of making a putt.
What Paul faces alone, like all golfers, is in swinging the club. He works with his coach, Owen O'Connor, a lot on a drill for balance and sensory perception. Owen will put the ball down and Paul thinks he is addressing the ball in the middle of his stance with a wedge, but he'll be incorrect and the ball is nearly opposite his right foot, known as false sensory perception. They work on it at the start of every lesson to negate the number of fat and thin shots in practice and play. The second issue is not being able to see the target. When Paul was 19 and shooting level par nines, as he calls it, he recalls being deadly accurate from 100 yards, 6 times out of 10 putting the ball to 15 feet. Today, though John is able to line him up so carefully and assess the strength of the shot, Paul needs a well-executed shot to hit the green.
After that, whether you can see the ball or not, it's all about feel. I suppose the only difference when you're blind is having the confidence to know that what you're feeling at the different points in the swing, from your grip pressure to your takeaway to, you know, to what you do to initiate the downswing, that acceleration and, you know, just the low follow through and all those things that you feel. So the golf swing is so fast that once you're set up properly, like any golfer should be able to just close their eyes and hit the ball. It's just muscle memory at that point.
Just as his coach Owen enjoys the challenge of coaching Paul in a different way, Paul relishes being able to share his experiences to help other people with a disability, which includes running sessions for youngsters at his club, some who, like Paul, are visually impaired. He says these sessions, supported so well by the members at his club, Gowran Park, a short distance from the city of Kilkenny, are proving fantastic for the youngsters. So just as Paul was inspired to open his mind to think about the value of inclusion by Catherine Lacoste and others, and from studying his own community around him, he is now helping to inspire others too. He writes to us, "There is also a huge added benefit for the parents and families getting together, so that the children and parents are all extending their social circle. And you can imagine how good that can be for families who have to face the hurdles of disability, sometimes feeling as if they are on their own." Paul also describes his recent experiences of travelling to Thailand and Costa Rica with the RNA to play tournaments and support local people with sight loss as a fantastic honour. Back in Ireland, he regularly teams up on projects with Golf Ireland, and he chairs a WhatsApp group for V1 players, highly visually impaired golfers, in which he is collating opinion and feedback on their experiences playing the game to share with a research team at Edgar. All these contributions have clearly helped Paul's identity as a golfer, not as a victim of circumstance, but as a strong competitor and a golfer you will want to share a fairway with. But it is more than that. Talking with him, Paul clearly has an extended capacity to listen and process information. This former engineer reminds us that the ability to listen is perhaps the best golf club in the bag. Golfers often cite another player who has inspired them, and Paul could list a cast of figures who have galvanised his mind to cope with sight loss, including his father Jerry's encouragement, and in a huge way from John, his guide and friend, from Dr. Catford's simple, careful words of wisdom, and then, of course, there is Catherine Lacoste. Catherine would have been inspired to play by her mother, the fine golfer Simone Thion de la Chaume, British Ladies Amateur Champion, 1927, and her father, René Lacoste, who, when he wasn't winning 7 Grand Slam tennis titles and producing crocodile-badged tennis shirts, was a 6-handicap golfer himself. And during our chat, Paul, an intelligent and shrewd follower of history, describes both Catherine Lacoste and Wexford's local world-famous writer Colm Tóibín as true trailblazers. I am sure Catherine would agree that her 15-year-old caddy at the Hermitage, circa 1979, has become a genuine trailblazer himself. And, Paul being Paul, he'd never forget the help of John for a second. This Edgar podcast was written and narrated by Ben Evans, and the sound production was by Martin Maynard of Sounds Good. You can find more stories of people with a disability thriving through golf in the profiles section of the Edgar website at edgargolf.com, and you can contact members of our team through the website.